On November 14, 1889, Nellie Bly, the crusading young female reporter for Joseph Pulitzer's World newspaper, left New York City by steamship on a quest to break the record for the fastest trip around the world. Also, departing from New York that day and heading in the opposite direction by train was a young journalist from the Cosmopolitan magazine, Elizabeth Bisland. Each woman was determined to outdo Jules Verne's fictional hero. Jules Verne's fictional hero, Phineas Fogg, and circle the globe in less than 80 days. The dramatic race that ensued would span 28,000 miles, captivate the nation, and change both competitors' lives forever. There's a new book out that tells this amazing story. It is called 80 Days. It brings these trailblazing women to life as they race against time and, of course, each other. It's a great pleasure to welcome the author, Matthew Goodman, to the program this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here with you.
Again, the name of the book, 80 Days, Nellie Bly and Elizabeth Bisland's history-making race around the world. Let us talk about, first, what brought you to this subject, what brought you to these two women and wanting to spend a great deal of time in investigating what they accomplished.
Sure. I live in Brooklyn, not far from the site of the old Nellie Bly amusement park. And I knew Nellie Bly as the namesake of that amusement park, and I knew she was a journalist. But I didn't really know that much else about her. And when I was kind of casting about looking for another book topic, I came across a reference to her. And I investigated further, and I found out that she was indeed a journalist, but not just any journalist, really an amazing journalist. She was, in the 1880s, an investigative reporter for Joseph Pulitzer's World newspaper, as you mentioned, which was the largest, most widely read newspaper of its time. New York had never seen a female journalist quite like her before. No one had ever been so audacious, so willing to risk her personal safety in pursuit of her story. In her very first story for the World, Nellie Bly feigned madness. She pretended to be insane in order to get herself committed to the Blackwell's Island Lunatic Asylum for women to experience firsthand the conditions, the horrible conditions that prevailed there, and spent 10 days inside the Lunatic Asylum. And it was really courageous because it wasn't sure that she was ever going to get back out. And it really took all of Pulitzer's doing to get her back out. And then she wrote an expose that changed the conditions of the asylum. So that was the kind of thing she did, this investigative undercover work. This is, of course, at a time when most women were forced to write simply for the women's page of the papers, writing about recipes and shopping and gossip and so forth. Nellie Bly was doing these undercover investigations. You know, she pretended to have to be a young mother to see if she could sell her baby on the black market. She exposed a corrupt Albany lobbyist. But then in the fall of 1889, she undertook her most exciting and audacious adventure yet, which was her attempt to go by herself, unchaperoned, carrying only a single bag, to go around the world faster than anyone ever had before her, to try to beat in real life the 80 days mark of Phileas Fogg that was set in Jules Verne's novel Around the World in 80 Days.
So when it comes to her competitor, Nellie Bly's name recognition is, yes, many of us may know it as a name in history or as an amusement park, but there is certainly more recognition with her than there is for her competitor.
That's right. And I was sort of captivated by this because I love the idea of Nellie Bly going around the world, but then I researched further and I discovered to my amazement that Nellie Bly wasn't only racing against the calendar or racing against this fictional character. She was racing against another young female journalist from a rival publication, the Cosmopolitan magazine, which became Cosmopolitan magazine, by the name of Elizabeth Bisland. And heading in the opposite direction, as you mentioned, Bisland going west, Nellie Bly going east around the world. Elizabeth Bisland and Nellie Bly were both pioneering young female journalists in New York at that time. But in terms of their personalities, they were so different. Nellie Bly came from Pittsburgh originally, from Western Pennsylvania. She was kind of scrappy and tough-talking, ambitious, really driven, kind of crusading. Elizabeth Bisland was this very genteel, extremely erudite literary poet from a ruined plantation in Louisiana, who had taught herself to read by reading burned copies of Cervantes and Shakespeare in the ruined library of her family's plantation, who taught herself French while she churned butter so that she could read Rousseau's Confessions in the original French. It turns out she's an equally fascinating and compelling person, but so different. You know, Elizabeth Bisland hosted tea parties, hosted a salon, literary salon, in her apartment. Nellie Bly was a regular at O'Rourke's Saloon on the Bowery. You know, so they were really very different women. And for me as a writer, it was wonderful because I had such two different but equally fascinating characters.
How aware were they of each other?
That's a great question. Elizabeth Bisland, basically what happened was Nellie Bly set out on the morning of November 14th, 1889, and the World, which was using her trip as a publicity stunt, trumpeted her departure on a front page story that morning. Well, the publisher of this rival publication, John Brisbane Walker, read about it that morning on the ferry coming over from New Jersey and said, and realized immediately the great publicity value of this scheme. And he got to the office that morning and summoned his literary editor, this beautiful young woman, Elizabeth Bisland, to his office. And she arrived there and he bade her a cordial good morning and said, I would like you to be on a railroad train this evening at 6 o'clock heading for San Francisco. And from there, you will proceed around the world. And if at all possible, I would like you to go around the world faster than anyone ever had before you. And she, of course, was shocked by this. And she said no. She didn't want to do it. She wasn't interested. She had nothing to wear. She said she had people coming to dinner. But the real reason, she admitted later, was that she understood immediately the sensation that this trip would cause, and she wasn't interested in that. She wasn't interested in being notorious. She cherished her anonymity. So that, you know, but she finally consented, and she set out that evening. So she knew right from the beginning about Nellie Bly. But Nellie Bly, who had left before Bisland, didn't find out about Bisland's challenge to her until she reached Hong Kong. So she had gone, you know, halfway around the world before she discovered that she had a competitor, and she was none the pleased. She was not at all pleased to discover it.
What was it? How much were they doing it for the paper? How much were they doing it for themselves? I guess was a question I kept on interested in the book, because it seems as though sometimes that, you know, they're getting great pressure. Certainly Bisland is getting great pressure to do this. And at what point does it become their own obsession?
Exactly right. You know, as I mentioned, Elizabeth Bisland didn't want to go in the first place. You know, she finally agreed to unwillingly and set out. But interestingly, she discovered over the course of the trip that she was in love with travel. She loved to travel. She had never been out of the country before. And this was an opportunity for her to see places that she would never have the opportunity to see otherwise. She fell in love with the Far East. She fell in love with Japan and China. You know, she saw these ancient water towers in Yemen at dawn, which she would never have had the opportunity to see otherwise. So even though she was doing it for her publisher and was trying as hard as she possibly could to win the race, there was this other thing, which was that she was having this incredible experience of travel, one that would last her the rest of her life. For Nellie Bly, it was a very different story. The idea to go around the world had been Bly's in the first place. It was a year earlier that she first went to her publisher and proposed this idea. And of course, he immediately told her, no, it was impossible. Only a man can do this, he said to her. You know, this was a time when male newspaper editors didn't feel comfortable sending their female reporters across the city unchaperoned by a man, much less around the world. And of course, he thought that, you know, you're going to have to take 11 steamer trunks. You can't possibly do a trip like this with so much clothing. And Bly insisted that she could and that she would, and said that if you send a man, I will work for some other publication and beat your man. and insisted on carrying only a single bag, one leather handbag, in which she brought everything that she would need for a 2.5-month trip around the world, because she wanted to give the lie to the notion that a woman, you know, couldn't do this kind of thing because of her need for luggage.
Was there I'm sorry, go ahead.
So for Nellie Bly, it was really all about the race, you know, that she said on more than one occasion that she would rather die than come back to New York behind time, you know, and she was constantly worrying about deadlines and schedules and telling, you know, ship's captains, more speed, more steam, because she was desperate to win the race. And for her, it really wasn't about travel so much as about winning.
For the individual publications, was there ever a concern that readers would find it improper, undignified, and unseemly that these two women were engaged in such an activity?
It doesn't seem that way, and both publications used the race to their benefit, and both earned, you know, hefty profits as a result. The World did an especially good job at promoting the race and promoting themselves as a result of the race. They were a daily paper, a morning paper, and every day there were articles in the paper about where Nellie Bly was that day, and, you know, getting people excited about the race, never mentioning Elizabeth Bisland, of course, only talking about their own racer, Nellie Bly. And a couple of weeks in, they hit on this, you know, incredible publicity device, which is that they created what they called the Nellie Bly guessing match, which was they offered a free trip to Europe for the reader who could come the closest to guessing Nellie Bly's final time around the world, down to the second. And people got incredibly excited about it. It was like a lottery, you know. But the only way that you could enter was to buy a copy of The World, because the entry form was inside The World. And so you had to cut out the entry form and write in your name and address and the time that you were guessing. And people went crazy doing this. And by the time the race was over, The World had accumulated almost 1 million entries in the Nellie Bly guessing match, which, of course, meant 1 million extra papers sold, or 1 million papers sold. So it was a huge publicity bonanza for The World.
We only have about a minute left, but you know, they became, certainly Nellie Bly became one of the most famous people, but you would think it would have this incredible bump in her journalism career, but it was sort of the peak, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, it's interesting and ironic. You know, Nellie Bly had made her success as an undercover reporter, you know, to investigate social ills, social abuses. Part of the problem of what happened was that by the time the race was over, she was arguably, as a result of The World's promoting her, arguably the most famous woman in America. Some people said that possibly the most famous woman in the world. She was known everywhere, and she went out immediately on a 40-city lecture tour. So she became so famous, and her face was so well known, that she could no longer do the kind of undercover investigative work that she was really best at and that she had really made her name at. So unfortunately, she wasn't able to do that kind of work anymore. And as you say, this race was really the high point of her journalistic career.
And, I mean, there was marketing, man. I mean, there were Nellie Bly fountain pens and horse feed and...
This was the time period in America where companies were first beginning to understand the value of associating their products with celebrities. And Nellie Bly was such a celebrity that, you know, women around the country were wearing the clothes that Nellie Bly wore on her trip around the world. Nellie Bly hats, Nellie Bly gloves, Nellie Bly dresses. You could use the Nellie Bly lamp and write with the Nellie Bly pen. There was There was even a Nellie Bly horse food. I mean, it was just Nellie Bly everything. You know, she was really one of the first female celebrities in the United States.
How did Elizabeth Bislin fare afterwards?
Well, quite well, as it turns out. You know, as I said, she wasn't interested in publicity. She came back to New York. Everybody was excited about her. Everybody wanted to know about her. And she turned her back on that and immediately left and went to England for a year. She wrote later that when the race was over, she wanted to live her life in such a way that her name would never again appear in a newspaper headline. And that's what she did. But she married very well. She met a man she loved who was a millionaire, and they built an estate out on Long Island. And she was writing wonderful essays. She was a beautiful writer. Wonderful collections of essays right up until her death, well into her 60s. So she had really a kind of wonderful and fulfilled life after the race.
I mean, as you write in the book, and hopefully without giving anything away, but, you know, it is hard to tell who the winner and the loser was.
That's right. That's right. And you know, as you say, I don't want to give anything away, but the race was neck and neck right up to the very end. And then one of them did win, but as it turns out, you know, the lives of these two women ended up going in very different directions at the end. Although by the end, and frankly, the epilogue is one of my favorite parts of the book, because by the end, they both had achieved a sense of fulfillment and satisfaction. And by the end, they were really both doing what it was that they wanted to do and were meant to do in their lives. They were really two remarkable, courageous, exciting, interesting women.
The book is amazing. It's 80 Days, Nellie Bly and Elizabeth Bislin's History-Making Race Around the World. It is published by Ballantine Books. Matthew Goodman is the author. Matthew's going to be at Oblong Books and Music in Rhinebeck next month, Sunday, April 7th, for a talk and signing at Oblong. Sunday, April 7th, you can find out more at oblongbooks.com. Oblongbooks.com. Matthew Goodman, a great pleasure. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
A delight. Again, the name of the book, 80 Days. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.